You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
When teachers complain about the ways that schools evaluate our teaching, and we do so with frequency and enthusiasm, one of the common refrains has to do with the measuring instruments and their inability to account for the randomness and adjustments to randomness that are part of every classroom experience. Many a story in the hallway involves a moment when a teacher's plans become irrelevant and the teacher responds. Sometimes in these stories we adapt, sometimes we invent, but as often as anything else, we improvise, a word we share with the worlds of jazz music and stage comedy. Nick Sorensen has taken that moment and proposed ways to evaluate the work of teachers in more complex and ultimately more adequate ways in light of that moment. And his recent book, The Improvising Teacher, Reconceptualizing Pedagogy, Expertise, and Professionalism, presents his research and some proposals for moving forward more intelligently. Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to welcome Dr. Sorensen to the show. Nick, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Nathan, and thank you for inviting me. It's a great opportunity to have a conversation.
Yeah. Very good. Your book sets forth some ideas for professional development aimed at teachers, and the distinctive quality of your introductory chapter is for long-term teacher development that posits the authorized teacher as the aim. So how do these points of focus and how do these terminologies differ from the models of professional development that you seek to improve?
Well, in England and Wales, and I'm sure it's the same in the States, we have a very clear and some would say quite a sort of stifling accountability framework, which sets out to evaluate the work of teachers, the success of schools, and the quality of teaching is at the heart of that. However, the consequence of that is that teachers feel that they have to behave in a particular kind of way in order to be seen as being either good or even outstanding. And from work that I did as a consultant, where I was in schools, I was working with teachers trying to bring about improvement of their practice, I realized that we needed to go further than just getting teachers to comply to criteria of what an outstanding teacher might be, for example. And I wanted to begin to articulate a view of teaching that takes account of the fact that improvisation is at the heart of expert practice and that affords some level of autonomy and a self-generated professional identity based on experience and context.
Very good. I want to move to your first full-length chapter where you provide some history of improvisation as a concept in teaching. And your history includes one of my own favorite rhetorical teachers, Quintilian, the Roman orator, and one of my favorite principles of rhetorical education, namely copia. So how does artistic improvisation for the Roman master of rhetorical education differ from artless improvisation? And how does he work copia into his idea of what teaching looks like?
Well, yeah, I mean, I discovering Quintilian was just fantastic for me because all of a sudden you had somebody who was talking about improvisation within a professional context. I mean, he was talking about the law. So it helped me enormously to say, look, we've got some great foundations to build on when we're talking about improvisation within the professional context of teaching. So for Quintilian, you know, an artless improviser would be somebody who just relies on their ingenuity. I mean, is really busking it. That is a facet of improvisation. They might have a talent for oral performance, but they haven't really developed a sense of structure of where they're going. And they haven't really developed a repertoire in which they can build on and exploit in the moment. So he then says, well, the artful improviser is somebody who is skilled in the subject that they're engaged in speaking about. They're knowledgeable and they do have a repertoire. And I think this is where copia comes in, that they are able to find a number of ways of doing the same thing or saying the same thing. It's an expansiveness. And I suppose at the heart of improvised teaching is the fact that teachers over a period of time will have a repertoire for a whole range of different things. I mean, they'll have a repertoire of different ways of asking questions of their students. They'll have a different way of managing the classroom. Simple things like the way that the students come into the room and the way they're greeted, the ways in which they might start a lesson or the way they might finish a lesson. They build up this this sort of very rich social resource that they can then employ as and when the need arises. I think one of the skills that improvising teachers have is that they can read the room and they can take the emotional temperature of what's going on. And so the class come in and they're really drowsy, they haven't got any energy. So the teacher's got a couple of things, like, hey, okay, right, 5 seconds, come up with, you know, three different words to explain this concept. Or the other way around, you know, the class might come in and they're just over the top, you know, they're really excited, overexcited, noisy. And then the teacher's got a way of calming them down, of bringing them to a focus. So that's the richness, the importance of repertoire and copia.
Very good. Yeah, this is one of my favorite moments kind of in the history of education, because, you know, with Plato's dialogues, you have this binary between either the techne, which involves, you know, first principles and involves, you know, very structured arguments. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, empiria, which is, you know, just, and I forget which phrase you used for it, but, you know, where I grew up, it was called winging it. Yes. And then, you know, Quintilian comes along and says, well, there really are moments of randomness and people who have studied really can handle them better. So it's one of those places where, you know, the real development is happening. So I really like that. But your book, of course, doesn't stick around in Roman antiquity, but it ventures into very recent developments in biology. So in that world, among biologists, what does the term emergence mean? And how does emergence relate to copia and to improvisation?
Right. Well, at the heart of my understanding of improvisation is the notion that there are two different kinds of structures. And so one kind of structure is what we call the design structures. Now, those are the things that are completely non-negotiable. Okay, there might be particular rules, for example, that a teacher has to obey, that you know, professional codes of conduct. But there are non-negotiables like the size of the classroom, the layout, the kind of furniture that's in there. There might be uniform that the students have to wear. And then there's a different kind of structure, which is called the emergent structures or the generative structures. And these are, as opposed to very formal structures, these are informal, where there is the potential for developing ideas. And for me, improvisation happens at the point where the dynamic relationship between these two different kinds of structures. And it's at... in terms of complexity theory, they talk about there are points of instability where things are not, you know, maybe not quite sure what's happening. And at that point, new ideas emerge, new practices emerge. And that's the way that I understand emergence.
Right. And I mean, in recent, evolutionary biology, I mean, it's precisely the analog to that, right? In complex life systems, new complexity is possible in ways that are not possible in less complex systems. So I think that's a really, really good metaphor for what you're doing here.
And what I was trying to do, and what I am doing in the book, is actually looking at the ways that different people have talked about improvisation, how they've articulated it in different cultures, in different times. And so, we can start with classical references to improvisation, to Aristotle talking about poetry and how poets improvise in order to reach their final form. Obviously, there's Quintilian. Then I followed it through to contemporary scientific insights that interestingly reference a world where. Well, as Heraclitus said, going right back to early philosophers, you never step into the same river twice, and I think, complexity theorists are taking that on board fully as being that seeing, hey, this is the way the world is. It's not predictable at all, but it's actually very fluid.
It's not predictable, and it also doesn't require a previous intention. So I haven't played jazz saxophone for more than 25 years, but your phrase, the intention to act without intention, strikes me as a very good starting point for thinking about what jazz musicians do. So, what about the intentional abandonment of intentions brings about the dialogic character of improvisational performance?
Yes, well, my own process of learning to play the saxophone and also to develop an approach as an improviser. I've been fortunate to come across and be taught by some wonderful saxophonists. And what comes through very strongly is that basically you spend the time, you go off, you do your woodshedding, and you learn as much as you can. You learn your scales, you learn your arpeggios, you learn the tunes, you learn the style, the language that you want to play in. But then in performance, it's not about replicating that note for note. It's not actually playing what you practice. It's actually just being in the moment and just seeing what happens, really. And something strange happens that actually, even though you're playing without intention, unconsciously you will fall back on the things that you have practiced, the work that you've put in. And one of my all-time favorite saxophonists was the wonderful Lee Konitz, and his approach was, I don't want to know what I'm playing beyond the note that I'm playing now. And to really try and get into the moment where you really are not thinking ahead, oh, I'm going to play this little riff now. It's really just responding to what's going on. And I think that approach, that understanding, that's something that is transferable to a whole range of different contexts.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. I want to talk a little bit about the terminology that we use specifically in educational context, because folks who have listened to me over the years know that I utterly detest any meeting that promises to relay best practices to the unfortunate teachers attending. That phrase isn't nearly precise enough for me to take it seriously. And your book proposes, I think, a strong alternative to that, namely advanced professional practice. So you already got me convinced, but convince our listeners, why is advanced professional practice better than best practices?
Well, the thing about a best practice is that there's only one, isn't there? I mean, if I say, what's your best? What's the best book you've ever read? All of a sudden, you're rejecting every other book you've read except the one, and it doesn't work like that. And it doesn't take into the account that okay, best practice is saying that there's only one, which, you know, good practice is singular and it's not, it's plural. And it also doesn't take into account context, because I think one of the things that we know about teaching is that actually what might work well in one school or one college or one university isn't actually transferable to another. You know, you've got to take into account context. So, yeah, I wanted to, let me just go back a bit. So my intention is to say that the best teachers improvise, that they are, that this is a facet of expertise, and therefore we can't say that this is a best practice, but we can say that it's a way of looking at advanced professional practice. It's really about sort of opening things up.
That makes good sense. And another facet of it that I appreciated is that it takes into account the person who is actually engaging in the practice. So, I mean, you know, the best ideas for someone who, like me, has been in the classroom for 25 years might be an extraordinarily bad idea for someone who is in his second year in the classroom. So, I mean, you know, it strikes me as a very attentive kind of measure, rather than a one size fits all. You know, this is the best no matter who you are, no matter where you are. So, I mean, you know, I think the complexity of it is ultimately what I appreciate the most.
I think, yeah, that's an important point, Nathan. And one of the things that came out of the research that I did, which was, you know, empirical research, I found 7 or 8 fantastic teachers. They allowed me to interview them and to observe their teaching. And one of the things that came through very strongly is that they were able to personalize what they were doing. And that actually was really important to them. That was really important in building the relationship between themselves and the class that they had. And they all had different ways in which they presented themselves in the classroom. But they came over as individuals, and they came over and their practice was personalized. And so, you know, I think that is really important. I think the other thing that came through is that, well, first of all, they didn't see themselves as experts. The way they said that, almost all of them said, "Oh no, I'm not, but I'm trying hard to become one," and that meant that the end goal of teacher development was something that they was continually to be worked at. And the thing about best practice is it says, "Okay, here's best practice. I can do that. I don't have to do anything else." Whereas they were continually questioning and reflecting upon their practice and wanting to find new ways in which they could be even better tomorrow.
Very good, very good. Another facet of expertise that your book digs into, and I really enjoyed this section, is from two researchers named Robinson and Howell. And they talk about expertise culminating in unconscious competence rather than conscious competence. So, you know, talk about that a little bit for our listeners. I mean, shouldn't a teacher's aim to know why we know as well as knowing that we know? Why are we aiming for unconscious?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing about unconscious competence is that is the problem that you face when you're trying to understand what expertise is, because actually experts know what to do in the moment. They don't necessarily rationalize it beforehand. So, for example, we could take a surgeon that's doing a very complex operation. Something goes wrong and they do it, you know. And somebody will say, "So, well, that was amazing. You know, how did you do that?" He said, "I don't know. I just, you know, I've done this for years and I've never come across that before, but I just thought that's the right thing to do." Now, my work with teachers is built on that assumption that actually a lot of the stuff that we do, particularly the good stuff we do, is actually done unconsciously. So if you like, an aspect of a teacher development workshop is to try and unpick that, to actually move the unconscious competences back into the realm of becoming a conscious competence, so that teachers are going, ah, I know what I'm doing, and then building on that, and then it becomes unconscious again. So it's part of the reflective process that you're moving somebody from taking something that they do unconsciously that's really good, and then making it conscious for them, and getting them to articulate it.
That makes good sense, and it reminds me of one of the best things that I ever learned, actually when I was in a college pedagogy class, back when I was a grad student, again, 25 years ago. Yeah. But they said, never, ever write AWK in the margin of a student paper. Right. They said, because what that means is you have a hunch that something's wrong, but you're not quite sure why it's wrong. Yeah. And if all you have is a hunch, you're not actually teaching anything.
Yeah.
And I took that with me, and I've made that my practice for 25 years. And I think it has made me a more reflective teacher whenever I teach writing, because I make sure that I don't grunt on my students' margins. I actually articulate what it is that I want them to do.
Yes.
Well, we are moving through the theoretical here, and I want to let our listeners know that this is a brief but a packed book. It's not that many pages, but every page raises questions that are worth serious further thought. But let's move on to your section on professions and the notions of the professional. Your historical survey of the 20th century and the 21st century argues that the professionalization of teaching hit its peak in the mid-20th century and then lost ground with the rise of Thatcher, and I'm going to add Reagan since I'm over here in the States, in the 1980s. What changes unfolded that took away the professional standing of teachers?
I think it was a number of initiatives, and I'm not saying that these were all bad, do you know what I mean? But they had cumulatively, I think they had quite a negative impact on the profession. So first of all, in the 1980s, we had a national curriculum introduced, okay, which meant that we hadn't had that up to this point, and that was basically saying every child is going to study these subjects. Within each subject, this is what they're going to learn, and also this is when they're going to learn it. All right, so you know, if you're history, you're going to be doing the Romans in primary school, and then after that you're going to be doing the Normans, and then you're going to be doing the Tudors. You know, it was giving a structure to a student's educational journey. Allied with that, if you've got a national curriculum, then you can also introduce tests. And so we have a series of tests that were introduced at various stages. The earliest was, you know, we're about in what we call year six. And then when you've got tests, you've got test results. And then you can compare one teacher's work against another teacher's work, but you can then also compare one class against another class. Then you can bring them all together, and you can start comparing schools against other schools. And that means that you can then, and this is what happened, schools are then put in league tables. So it's part of the process by which the marketplace was brought into education in England. And as I say, there are some good things about it, but the impact that it had was that teachers were in a position where they were told what to do. And in certain respects, for example, in the teaching of literacy, they were told how to teach and when to teach it. And so a lot of their autonomy was taken away from them. And so I think what I'm what I found that I needed to do is, having reached the point where I could make some clear statements about improvisation and teaching and how important this is, particularly when it's artful improvisation, and what it means, that I also needed to then go back and say, well, if this is what great teachers do, we probably need to look at the way that we talk about professionalism.
That makes good sense. And one of the things that, you know, I really noticed coming from an American perspective is that you're right. I mean, you know, in the States in 1983, I mean, it's the book A Nation at Risk that really sets standardized testing mania in motion in the United States, and especially in American schools. So, I mean, you know, this these forces that you're talking about, I mean, you know, they definitely have a mirror across the pond.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, just before you turn to your own empirical research, you dig into a question of how we conceptualize and measure the effectiveness of schools. So, I mean, in the UK, I mean, what terms are conventional when people measure schools for effectiveness, like you were just talking about? And when people use those conventional terms, what kinds of problems arise? What kinds of things do we miss when we use the current vocabulary for measuring one school against another?
Well, the organization that plays a key role in evaluating schools is called Ofsted. And there's a very, very clear, very detailed framework that schools have to work to. And then there are four basically levels, which is requiring improvement, satisfactory, good, or outstanding. And the problem with that, and certainly there's been, you know, quite a significant and deeply tragic incident where, in fact, a primary school teacher was so upset by the Ofsted process that actually she committed suicide, and therefore that the whole framework is now being reviewed. But the issue is that how can you take everything that a school does and sum it up in one word? You know, how can you say that it's, you know, that it's good or requiring improvement or outstanding? And it avoids the subtleties and also the range of things that a school does. So a school, yes, might have areas where there's needs for improvement, and I'm certainly not saying that there shouldn't be some kind of evaluative process so that can be identified. But also, there are some areas for improvement. There might be some real strengths, and they're going to be different, you know, for each school, and they're going to happen in different areas. So that's really the that's the key issue in terms of effectiveness, that we need a broader view of what constitutes a good school and how that is reported to parents.
Very good. Now, a lot of the second half of your book really kind of details this research study on teacher expertise that we've been alluding to. So remember that our listeners will want to go out and get your book and read your book. But in broad terms, what are your methodologies? What kinds of things were you measuring? What kinds of things were you looking for? What sets your study apart from some studies that have come before you?
Well, I'm not sure that there were many studies of improvisation in teachers, so I sort of had to create my own methodology for that. I wanted to say something about improvisation. I wanted to say something about what great teachers did. I wanted to find that out. So I decided to do a small scale study. There were about seven teachers that were involved, And I went to the head teachers, first of all, because they were going to be the gatekeepers to the study. And my dilemma was, how do I know they're going to be expert teachers? I mean, if I draw up a list of what I think an expert teacher is, and then I go into a school and I'm looking at a teacher and they don't meet my criteria, what am I going to do then? So I suddenly had a light bulb moment. I thought, I'm not going to decide that. I'm going to actually say to the head teacher, can you describe what you think an expert teacher is? What does it mean in your school? And then I said, so can you find me somebody that meets that description? And would you think, would they be prepared to take part in my research? And so that then got me into the area of that expertise is culturally situated. And I then interviewed the teachers and saw five of their lessons over a period of time. And after each lesson, we had a post-observation interview. And then I did a final interview with them afterwards to sort of basically say, how are you? Thank you very much for doing this research. What did it mean to you? And give them a sense of what my findings were as they were emerging. So the methodology that I took was to develop a grounded theory. So I transcribed all the interviews and I went through them and started coding them. And then so drawing out themes about what these teachers did and what was improvisational and how did they improvise. And that's and so I came up with a model of I suppose the improvising teacher.
Very good, very good. Now, I mean, as you were conducting this, you know, one of the things that you focused on just now is that, you know, you went in to find out, I mean, you know, what head teachers, and by the way, this book taught me that, because most of my knowledge of British schools comes from Dickens novels, I thought they were called headmasters, but what head teachers thought, you know, expertise was. I mean, what kinds of common ground and what kinds of range did you find when you interviewed these head teachers?
I found that, first of all, they were really interested in taking part in the research, that they really enjoyed talking about it. In many cases, they were trying to establish approaches to teaching in their school that went beyond the national curriculum and the kind of things that they were the things that they were prescribed to do, or they saw that as a deficit model, that they had a sense of we could do things better than that. They were very keen to talk about the humanity of teachers. In fact, one of the head teachers, in fact, the head teacher in the pilot study that I did, he said, "I know who you need to see for your research. It's her humanity. Her humanity comes through." So they were really interested in the relationship in the classroom, and that the teachers were to be seen as humans, that to be warm, to be empathetic with students, and were able to create, you know, a rich and rewarding learning environment for their students.
And then the other thing that struck me when you're describing your study is that you were focused on the cultural situatedness of teaching and of expertise in teaching. And yeah. I'm curious to hear you say, the national curriculum, the national tests, the national rankings, do you think that they attempt to separate schools and teachers from their cultural situation? Do you think that they just imagine cultural situation imprecisely? How do the previous models relate to that cultural situatedness, do you think?
I think that certainly the schools that I visited, and it was, I mean, it's a small sample, but what they did have in common is that they wanted their school to have an ethos and a culture that met the professional values and beliefs of the head teacher and the leadership team that was there. And that was really important, so that their culture, the culture of the school, would then dictate how the statutory requirements were going to be addressed. It wasn't the other way around, that the statutory requirements would, if you like, set the tone for the culture of the school. They wanted to make sure that their values and beliefs were transmitted as well as, and as a way of working with the statutory requirements.
Very good, very good. One of the questions that your book raises, really right after you describe the study, has to do with why we do educational research. And I found it interesting because, honestly, I haven't reflected on this enough myself, because one of the points you make is that too many of the studies that we do have as their goal predicting teacher effectiveness. And certainly I'm familiar with this because, you know, I mean, this is why teachers worry about, you know, standardized tests and national tests and so on and so forth, because they're afraid that these tests are going to predict bad things for them and therefore the school is going to get rid of them. But you propose as an alternative to understanding teaching at a conceptual level. So here's my question for you. What do we gain? What kinds of things can we understand better when we have this conceptual understanding as our goal rather than prediction?
For me, research is, I mean, there's nothing better than actually observing what a teacher actually does as opposed to what they should be doing. You know, I always enjoyed, and it's a real privilege to be invited into a classroom, to be able to sit there and to watch a great teacher working with a group of students and seeing learning happen. And so my intention was to start with that, actually, and to, in a way, you know, alongside deciding that I didn't have to have a definition of what an expert teacher was, it was like, it was going in almost with a blank slate, you know, a tabula rasa, and just say, okay, let me just look, and I just want to look and see, and I want to talk to you and find out what you're doing and why you're doing it and what works and what doesn't work, in order to then explain that in conceptual terms, to provide a language, a framework in which other people, you know, can talk about teaching as an improvisational act. Does that make sense?
That makes good sense. Now, one phrase that I picked up on there is tabula rasa, because earlier you described your study not mainly as a statistical study and not mainly even as an experimental study, but as an empirical study. And, you know, tabula rasa, of course, is a phrase I associate with John Locke mainly, but with empiricists more generally. In your view, I mean, you know, if your approach is broadly empiricist, and if it's not, let me know if I'm just grasping at straws here, by all means, feel free to say so. But if your excellent. If your methodology is broadly empiricist, what kinds of things depart from empiricism in the way that we normally study schools, and how might we benefit from some more empiricism?
Well, I think that there's a lot to be gained by, you know, observing teachers, but not just observing teachers against, if you like, a scorecard. You know, I'm going to rate you so many points for doing this and so many points for doing that. But doing that and then having a dialogue with the teacher. And, you know, so how do you think that lesson went? You know, I mean, I might think this is a fantastic lesson. And they say, how do you think it went? And the teacher goes, oh, dear, it was hard work today. You know, I didn't, you know, I just couldn't get where I wanted to be with them, you know. And so then you have a dialogue about that. So I think that, I suppose it comes down to my understanding and my beliefs about teacher development is that it comes out of dialogue, and it comes out of dialogue with a critical friend who will look at you, who will see what you're doing, who can ask questions in a way that allows you to think, maybe I could do that better next time.
That sounds good. I want to focus on another term that reemerges towards the end of your book that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation. That is emergence. Because earlier we talked about emergence as it relates to notions of improvisation, of course. But yeah. Towards the end of the book, you talk about emergent power that, you know, comes out of self-reflection. And you talk about it as an alternative to imposed power. So what is it? How do teaching communities benefit when power emerges rather than descending from on high?
What I'm talking about there is I suppose it's the professional knowledge and understanding that is contained within teachers that is acknowledged and accepted as being important, and so that it then is it comes back to what we were talking about head teachers, is that one of their skills was that they would empower their teachers. You know, they would say, look, I realize that teachers could get to a certain point where they'd arrive at the school, they'd prove themselves as being efficient, as effective, that their teaching is consistently of a good or if not outstanding quality, and that the head teacher says, well, look, I can trust that person, so off you go, you do things, you know, whatever you do, I know is going to be good. I don't have to keep an eye on you. Continually question what you're doing and why you're doing it. I recognize that you have sufficient experience, knowledge, expertise, a positive relationship with the students, and also that you, I suppose, fit in with and reflect the ethos of the school. And so therefore, it's an empowering process that comes to teachers. I think that's what I mean by sort of an emergent power.
Really. That makes good sense. And one question that I have as a follow-up to that is, one of the things that I'm going to say scares American schools, or at least scares the schools that I've been affiliated with, about that kind of emergent model, is the specter of inconsistency, and really what's at the root of that, parental complaints about inconsistency. Well, you know, my child is in this person's room, and, you know, this person is doing things that are more difficult, and therefore, you know, my student's grades are suffering because they're not in somebody else's room that does things differently. First of all, I mean, you know, is that exclusively an American problem, or is that something that occurs in the schools you observe too, or do you just deal with it differently, or is it still a problem both in the United Kingdom and in the United States?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure, Nathan, really. I mean, yes, you know, head teachers, you know, do get are put under pressure from parents. Certainly, if the parent feels that their child is being treated unfairly or is not given the opportunities that other children get. I'm not sure. I think, you know, students and parents, as well as head teachers and other members of staff, they know a good teacher, you know, when they come along. And so, you know, if a child is coming back and say, oh, I really enjoy those lessons, you know, my teacher is they're really great. I really enjoy working with them. They're not going to complain about that, really.
That makes good sense. That makes good sense. Now, in the book's penultimate chapter, you dig into a model of authorized teacher, which is a phrase we've talked about before, that involves three cognates of authorized. So you've got authenticity, you've got authorization, and you've got authoring. So take a moment with each of these and tell our listeners how each helps us to understand things and what we look for when we're looking for all three of these things that we might miss if we're not looking for them.
So certainly one of the things that did come out of the research is that is the view from head teachers that they wanted teachers to be themselves in the classroom. And also one of the characteristics of the improvised teachers is that they found their ways in which to personalise their practice, personalise their relationships. So that it seems that being perceived as authentic, as a real person by the students is really, really important. And you know, that's also been commented on in relation to leadership. You know, there's a book called The Authentic Leader by Neil Thompson. You know, it seemed to me that that would be a prerequisite for a new notion of professionalism for me. So authorization comes out of the notion of being authentic, but it's what we were talking about earlier. It's about the empowerment of the self, of actually being empowered, but also feeling empowered to influence what is going on in your classroom, empowered to take maybe statutory requirements and say, the best way of doing this is this way. So it's also about teachers having a sense of their own value and their own worth. And then the third concept, authoring, is quite an interesting one, really. But it's about with the origination or the writing, which might not be literally writing, but it's the way that teachers write or create their own professional identity. So it's what makes them a teacher. What is generic about that? What do they do that all teachers do? But what is also unique about them and the way that they teach? Because again, I feel that I think this is something that you touched upon earlier on, Nathan, is that you know, people do teach in their own way. They've got their own strengths, and teaching is a relational act, and therefore we need to enter into that relationship, well, authentically as ourselves, but we also need to be able to understand it. And I think the notion of authoring came from work that I did when I was in the education department at Bath Spa University. I was involved in working with teachers on a master's education programme where they were able to research and explore and an aspect of their own practice or an educational initiative that they were particularly interested in. And it seemed to me that process of professional development, which involves stepping back, analysing what you're doing, relating it to some theoretical framework, is just enormously important. It empowers teachers, and it also develops their own authenticity. So, yeah, that's how those concepts all fit together. And I just came up with this. I just thought, well, I needed to, I needed to go further than just saying great teachers improvise, and it's a facet of expertise. We can't just accept that. We need to say, if we're going to accept that as being at the core of an advanced professional development, then we need to reconsider what exactly do we mean by professional. So I suppose this is a provocation really for people to sort of rethink what does it mean when I say that I'm a professional.
Very good. Well, I want to talk about professional development in particular as we kind of reach the end here. And at least in the American context that I'm familiar with, professional development runs along a kind of spectrum. So on one end of the spectrum, the one that I like the least, they herd teachers into a large room and someone talks to them for an hour. And then, you know, you take attendance and everyone goes back and does probably what they were going to do, even if they hadn't been sitting in that room for that hour. Yeah. On the other end of that spectrum, the end that I much prefer, teachers, either individually or in groups that they form on their own initiative, study the things that they find interesting and, you know, they find promising for their own learning. And, you know, as long as that is documented, as long as, you know, you can demonstrate to the school that you were, in fact, doing something rather than nothing, then that can be professional development. So, first of all, you know, if that spectrum doesn't at all describe what you're after, you can say so and propose an alternative. But, you know, where do your ideas for professional development fall on that spectrum, if we're going to put it somewhere on that spectrum?
For a period of time, I worked as a consultant. So I was employed to go into schools and to work face to face with teachers that required improvement. And basically the job was to move them through the four Ofsted criteria, you know, from inadequate through satisfactory to good to outstanding. And each of those are clearly described in the Ofsted framework. And after a while, I just thought, this doesn't work for me, because for an outstanding teacher, there's only one way to go, and that's downhill. all of a sudden, well, last week I was outstanding, this week I'm only good, I've got to work again. And so I wanted to reframe the notion of teacher development. So I think, what are we teaching? What's the end goal? What's the end state of teacher development? And the way that I described it for me was that most teachers, when they go into the classroom, you know, they've got to establish themselves as a teacher. It's transmitting knowledge. I'm the teacher. You're the students. This is what we're going to learn. So it's what we call a teacher-focused classroom. And I thought, well, hang on. The development is to a learner-centered classroom, where in fact teachers are not necessarily all the time transmitting knowledge, but they're facilitating learning and possibly learning alongside the students, and the students might even be teaching the teacher. There might actually be this very creative transference of roles. So that's the way that I viewed it. And of course, as soon as I started thinking in those terms, then every teacher in the school could engage with this on this journey. And it's not necessarily a linear journey, because it's circular, because after a while, I mean, a good teacher, you know, as part of their repertoire, needs to be able to stand at the front and say, right, okay, for the next 20 minutes, you got to know this stuff. You know, I'm going to have to teach you this. But then we can do some different things, and I'm going to set you, well, you're going to set your own learning goals as to where you're going to take that information, where you're going to take that knowledge, what you want to do with it. And so that's where I am. So, yeah, so to relate it to your example, it's, yeah, in terms of teacher development of activities, yes, it's moving away from getting everybody in a room and say, this is what you've got to do, and actually creating more of a seminar situation where people are saying, group work, that's actually quite difficult to get students to work in a group and to make sure they're all learning in a group. So this is the strategy that I've come up with. And then other teachers, oh, that's, I'm going to try that. And then the next time you meet, I did try that. Some of it worked really well. I had a problem with this, but I invented a new way of doing that. And so, you know, you're continually sharing things that work.
Good, 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 good. In the book's final chapter, you claim that the COVID-19 pandemic and its effects on schools highlight the need for teachers to regain autonomy, which, of course, is another one of those cognates with authorized and author and authoritative and so on and so forth, and also professional agency. So take a moment here at the end and connect these dots. How does autonomy stand as a worthwhile response to the challenges of COVID lockdowns?
Well, I wrote the book. Most of the book was actually written during lockdown, or the final draft of it was. I'd completed my PhD in 2014. And I think feedback from the Routledge, the publisher, said it would be really good to sort of say something about about the pandemic, because that so much, it changed so much in education across the world. So I just made some contacts with teachers across the world that I put a shout out, and various teachers were good enough to respond to that. But of course, certainly it was the case in the UK, and I know it was happened in other countries across the world. You know, lockdown happened. It was an unprecedented event, and governments didn't know what to do. You know, they and the major issue was the health thing, but they didn't have a policy to say, well, in a lockdown, this is what schools need to do, this is what teachers need to do. So, you know, all of a sudden, there was an educational situation where all of a sudden there weren't any rules anymore. And what fascinated me is that in all sorts of different ways, teachers improvised and use their autonomy to make things happen, because nobody else was telling them what they had to do. And it, in all sorts of different ways, they were devising new ways of learning. They were, I mean, our university, Bath Spa University, in a week became an online university. And I'm sure we weren't alone in that. But and, you know, the staff who hadn't really used Teams that much, you know, they hadn't really engaged with it because they hadn't needed to, all of a sudden, how do we do a lecture on online? You know, how do we run a seminar? How do we do meetings? It was and again, right across the world, people were finding different ways of making education work. So it was just really nice to be able to show, in a way, how important improvisation for teachers was, because actually when you're faced with the unprecedented, you've got professional expertise to draw upon that can be utilised. And they were doing remarkable things. I mean, you know, in England, teachers were putting together learning packs. They were taking them round to houses. But then they were also using that as an opportunity to find out, did the families have enough to eat? You know, because a lot of the children might have been having free school meals. So they were stepping into that sphere of just checking that things were okay within the family, as well as the education, the social and the educational aspects of life were being supported and dealt with. So.
Very good. Well, Nick, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation. So in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about improvisation, teaching, or whatever else as we head for the door?
Well, I think I would like them to think about a time when they were aware that they had done a bit of improvising. I mean, it might be, they might be a teacher, they might have done it in the classroom. It might have been at home, something might have gone wrong, they've sort of built something in a, you know, using what materials that were available. They might have looked in the fridge and decided that they haven't got much to eat, but there's some interesting, an interesting combination of food. I'd like them to think about a time when they did improvise and then to reflect on, so what was good about that and what did I learn about that and how could I do that again? My final thoughts are that I think there are two things that the improvising teacher has, and that can apply to any social context, is that you develop an improvisational mindset. You think, you know, what's improvisation about? How do improvisers think about the world? And then you develop the skills of, you know, connecting with people, connecting ideas, being adaptable, building dialogue, and seeing everything as an opportunity, noticing what's happened, and actually saying, well, even mistakes can be take you somewhere interesting and somewhere new.
Nick Sorensen, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Nathan, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a real privilege and it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is The Improvising Teacher, Reconceptualizing Pedagogy, Expertise, and Professionalism from Routledge. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.